Ladies and gentlemen, United States Air Force, I was in the Navy, which stands for Never Again Volunteer Yourself. And I want to go back to September 29th, 2006, or 2007, actually. That's when Petty Officer Michael Mansour is a United States Navy SEAL operating in Ramadi, Iraq. It was working. Hold on, stand by. Talk awkwardly amongst yourselves. Hang on. Stand by. We're experiencing technical difficulties. Please stand by. Hey, Manny. Nobody can see you. Don't worry about it. Nobody can see you. We're not getting a feed? There he is. Michael Mansour is a United States Navy SEAL operating in Ramadi, Iraq. He's standing on a roof in Ramadi. He's standing in front of a doorway to this roof. He has two Navy SEAL teammates lying in the sniper-prone position next to him. They've already taken AK-47 fire and a rocket-propelled grenade, but they're not exactly sure where the enemy is. There's a bit of a lull in the fighting. Insurgents have blocked off the streets in Ramadi, and there's someone on the loudspeaker in the town mosque yelling, "Kill the Americans!" As Mansour and his team are looking for the next attack, an insurgent from an unknown location throws a grenade up on the roof. It hits Mansour in the chest, and it falls to his feet. Due to the length of the throw, there's no opportunity to pick it up and throw it back. He has only a split second to make a decision. He can leap through the doorway behind him and save himself, but if he does, his two teammates lying on the roof will surely die. Mansour yells, "Grenade!" But instead of jumping backward to save himself, he jumps forward, chest first, onto the grenade. It detonates. 30 minutes later, 25-year-old Michael Mansour is dead. His two teammates lying on the roof receive only minor injuries because Mansour's body muffled the blast. One of the survivors said at Mansour's funeral, "Mikey looked death in the face that day and said, 'You will not take my friends, I will go in their stead.'" I've never seen a United States president cry until April of 2008. That's when President George W. Bush invited Mansour's parents into the East Room of the White House to give them their son's Medal of Honor posthumously. The president couldn't even get through the citation without breaking down. Since then, Mansour's high school in Garden Grove, California, built a new stadium. They named it Michael A. Mansour Memorial Stadium. The golden trident that the SEALs wear dominates the 50-yard line. January 2019, North Island, California, just outside of San Diego, the United States Navy commissioned the USS Michael Mansour, the newest guided missile destroyer in the fleet, Zumwalt class. This is Mansour's mother, Sally, being escorted onto the ship, named in honor of her fallen son. Now, why did they do this? Because Michael Mansour literally sacrificed himself to save his friends. "There's no greater love than to sacrifice yourself to save your friend," said Jesus of Nazareth before he went to the cross. Michael Mansour sacrificed himself to save his friends. The question is, would anybody sacrifice himself to save you? And the answer is, someone already has. His name is Jesus of Nazareth. Now, why did he do this? Paul, writing the most theologically complete letter in the entire Bible wrote in Romans chapter 3 about Jesus. He did this so that he, God, would be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. Why is this important? Because this explains why Jesus is the only way. But you might ask yourself the question, how could Jesus be the only way? With all these other religions out there, with all the people out there who have never heard, how can Jesus be the only way? So what we're going to try and do in this final session is answer three questions. The first question is, only Jesus claiming to be the only way? Because you would think only Christianity makes exclusive claims. Secondly, what about those who have never heard? Because if he is the only way, then we have a moral problem here, because it appears that God doesn't love everybody because he hasn't gotten everybody the opportunity to be saved. And then finally, we're going to answer the question directly, why is Jesus the only way? Now, I'm assuming here that the Bible's true, and Jim has just given you evidence that it is. If you want to get more evidence like that, we have some books on the book table. And if you text the word evidence to 44222, I'm going to send you an entire PowerPoint presentation that's going to give you the I don't have enough faith to be an atheist presentation for why we know that the Bible is true, why God exists, why miracles are possible, why the New Testament's true. And all of those products are back there on the book table. And I want to point out that all the proceeds from the sale of those books and DVDs will go to feed needy children. Mine. Okay? Just so you know. I got three sons, so I need some help, all right? In fact, the one we're going to probably talk about, or the book that has most of what we're going to talk about today, is this one, Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. I've noticed that when atheists are arguing there is no God, they're actually stealing aspects of reality that would only exist if God existed in order to say he doesn't exist. In effect, they have to sit in God's lap to slap his face. All right, so let's get started here because we have a lot to cover. The first point is only Jesus claiming to be the only way? Let's look at some of the major world religions, because you're going to find out that actually there are many only ways. In other words, every world religion virtually is claiming exclusivity. Christianity, of course, does. Christianity actually gives you a choice. You can be with God or be separated from God, heaven or hell. It gives you a choice, but it says salvation is by grace. You don't earn your salvation. Jesus did all the work for you. In fact, you do not achieve your identity. You do not achieve your salvation. You receive your identity. You receive your salvation. It's completely by grace. Islam is also exclusive. Your choice is either paradise or hellfire. In fact, Surah 5, fifth chapter in the Quran, says unbelievers will be inmates of hellfire, and maybe some Muslims too will as well. Why? Because there's no guarantee you're going to be saved in Islam. The only way you can guarantee salvation in Islam is jihad. If you die as a martyr, you're automatically in. But otherwise, it's up to Allah to figure out whether your good deeds outweigh your bad. What about Hinduism? You don't have a choice in Hinduism. There's no choice. Why? Because you're locked into karma. You can't get out. Oh, well, you might ultimately be able to get out if you get absorbed into Brahman, which means your personality goes away. So you really don't have a choice in Hinduism. Do you have a choice in Buddhism? No, not really either, because everyone, again, is subject to the law of karma. You're trapped in reincarnations until you achieve nirvana. Now, there is some variability among different kinds of Buddhists, but this is essentially what they believe. How about atheism? Well, you don't have a choice at all. You're just going to become worm food, right? That's it. There is no afterlife. It's over. Fine. It's done. How about the coexist bumper sticker, pluralism? You don't have a choice there either. That's compulsory heaven for everybody. You got to go be with Jesus. I don't want to be with Jesus. I've been running from Jesus my entire life. Sorry, you're in. So, notice there are many only ways. Everybody virtually is claiming to be the only way. The question is this really true? What is really true? Now, if you think about just rationally speaking, a lot of times there is only one way to get something done. There was only one way to take out the Nazis. We were going to have to land on the European continent. Otherwise, we could have never liberated Europe. There's sometimes only one way to get out of a building. This man is evacuating people out of the World Trade Tower on 9/11. There's only one way. You take this stairway to life, you don't take it, you die. Sometimes there's only one way to save your friends. The only way he could was to dive on the grenade. There's no other way. So he did. Secondly, what about those who have never heard? We've already established that just about everybody's claiming exclusivity. In fact, truth is exclusive, right? If I say 2 plus 2 equals 4, I'm excluding every other number when I say that. But what about those who have never heard? If we're going to say Christianity is true, how can we say that God is loving? Now, this turns out to be a moral problem. What do I mean by a moral problem? 70% of the questions I get on college campuses, or is it campi? I don't know. 70% of the questions have something to do with morality. Why did God kill the Canaanites? What about LGBTQ? What about why, if there is a good God, why is there evil? If there is a good God and Christianity's true, what about those that have never heard? It seems to impugn the morality and love of God. If he hasn't given his word to everybody, then how can he be a loving being? He's infinitely just, but he's not infinitely loving. Well, let's deal with this directly. The first point is that everyone has heard. There's nobody out there who's never heard of God. Everybody knows that there's a moral creator out there. Why? Because of creation and conscience. You don't need the Bible to know this. Before there was a Bible, people knew this. This is called natural revelation. Everyone has it. Now, what does the Bible teach about this? Well, it teaches this in Romans chapter 1 and Romans chapter 2. In fact, if you look at the great book of Romans, chapter 1 is creation. That's evidence for God, creation and design, basically. Chapter 2 is conscience, that you have a moral law written on your heart. Chapter 3 is Christ. Christ is special revelation, which comes through the scriptures. But the first two, everybody has. So there's no one out there who's never heard of God. What does the Bible teach about natural revelation? It teaches that if you seek him, he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him, then you will get the evidence you need to be saved. In fact, that's point two. If people seek God through the light they have, God will get them the gospel so they can be saved. In fact, if I shine a pen light in your eyes and you turn away, is it going to be helpful if I shine a big flashlight in your eyes? No, you're going to turn away from that too, aren't you? If you move away from the light of nature, the light of the gospel isn't going to help because you're already running from the light you have. In fact, I ask this question to every audience I have the opportunity to speak to. This is just for the Christians in this audience. If you're a non-Christian, thank you for being here, but this question's not for you. This is just for the Christians. Christians, let me ask you a question. I want you to think of somebody you know who's not a Christian, whom you'd like to be a Christian. Friend, relative, somebody like that. Everybody got somebody? Okay, here's my question about the person you're thinking of. Is the person you're thinking of on a relentless pursuit of truth? They want to know if Christianity's true. Or are they apathetic or maybe even hostile to Christianity? How many people say the person I'm thinking of right now is on a relentless pursuit of truth? They want to know if Christianity's true. Crickets. Anybody in the balcony? No. How many people say the person I'm thinking of is apathetic or hostile? Yeah, look around the room. It's the same everywhere I go. People are looking for God like a criminal's looking for a cop. Right? They don't want God to exist. Why? Because they want to be God of their own lives. That's why I always ask people who are not Christians, if Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? I've had atheists stand at the microphone on college campuses in front of hundreds of people. I ask that question, if Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? No! No? I thought you were reasonable. I thought you were rational. How's that reasonable? It's not. The problem isn't here, the problem's here. They don't want it to be true. They don't want there to be a God. Why? They want to be God of their own lives. God's getting in the way. They're not on a truth quest, they're on a happiness quest. And they're just going to believe whatever they think is going to make them happy. The problem is you can make yourself happy over the short term doing a lot of fun but ultimately destructive things. Yet over the long term, it's a disaster. And everyone in here who's over 40 knows what I'm talking about, right? Because many of us have tried it ourselves. The only way to get true contentment and happiness is to go straight through truth, and Jesus is the truth. So I don't buy the idea that people are seeking for God. Most people are not. And if they're not responding to the natural revelation, creation and conscience, they're not going to respond to special revelation, the gospel. Now, there's one more point we need to make here. It could be that God has so ordered the world so that those who never hear the gospel wouldn't have believed it anyway, right? I mean, you know people who hear the gospel, they were all the people you were just thinking of a minute ago, and they're not interested, right? It could be that people who never hear the gospel would have the same response, right? Even if you were to tell them about it, they go, nope, thanks anyway. Got my own thing going over here. In fact, is this just speculation? No, I think there's evidence for this. In fact, this is Mars Hill. You know where Mars Hill is? This is my son, Austin, posing as Paul. He's posing as Paul on Mars Hill, where Paul, in Acts 17, gives his famous speech right there to the Athenian philosophers, and right behind him back there is the temple to Athena, where we get the city Athens from. So Mars Hill is right there. And what kind of guts did Paul have? He's there talking to all these Athenians, the same council, by the way, that sentenced Socrates to die. And he says, God does not dwell in temples built by human hands. What's behind him? The temple they built to Athena. So he's kind of poking him in the eye here. And then he gets to the point in his presentation, his little sermon to him, and he says this: from one man, God made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. In other words, he's saying here that God has so prearranged events that the people who hear the gospel, or the people that want to hear the gospel, would hear it. God has put people where he wants them to be. So it could be that those who never hear the gospel wouldn't have believed it anyway, which of course solves the problem. Now, what we do, because we know how people are saved, is we risk all to get them the gospel. We're told to make disciples of all nations. Notice, by the way, Jesus didn't say make believers. You notice that? He didn't say make believers of all nations. He said make disciples of all nations. Do you know the word Christian is only used 3 times in the New Testament? The word disciple is used almost 300 times. There's a difference. We're supposed to be followers, not just believers. So, it could be that this is the answer to the so-called problem. And Dr. William Lane Craig has done a lot of work on this. If you really want to dive into this possibility, go to reasonablefaith.org and type in, what about those that have never heard, if you really want to get into it. But since God is just, he's the standard of justice, we know that nobody in the afterlife is going to get a raw deal, right? Nobody's going to go, God, if I had only known. No. In fact, Jesus dealt with that, speaking to Lazarus. Not the Lazarus he rose from the dead, but the Lazarus, the rich man in Hades. When Lazarus says, go tell my brothers about this. What does Jesus say? They're not even going to believe if someone rose from the dead. It's not a head problem, it's a heart problem. It's not about God's existence, it's about their resistance. They don't want to believe in God. So let's spend most of our time on the big question. And that is, why is Jesus the only way? And I think we can start with the Ark of the Covenant. What's the Ark of the Covenant? You know the Ark of the Covenant. Come on. Come on. Are you going? You mean that's in the Bible? Yeah, we gotta go back to the Bible. We gotta go back to 2 Samuel. Well, let me set it up first. You see how they're carrying the ark here? They got these poles through the ark, and they're transporting it. This is the way God said to move the ark around. You know what's in the ark is the Ten Commandments, right? And God is supposed to dwell there in the ark, and they would carry this into battle and slay the enemies with this thing. And we know that if you open it, your faces will melt. We know all this, right? Anyway, they were supposed to transport it this way, but David is trying to get the ark to Jerusalem after he's taken Jerusalem. And he decides, well, you know what? We don't really have to put the poles in it. Let's just put it on the back of an oxen. And we'll just kind of walk it into Jerusalem. So they're doing that. And here's what happens as they're walking in, trying to get to Jerusalem. They're quite a ways from it. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark of God because the oxen stumbled. Now, you're not supposed to touch the ark, right? You're not supposed to touch it. But he reaches out because the oxen stumbled. Then the Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore, God struck him down and he died there beside the ark of God. And David was annoyed. In fact, here's what David said. Then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah. And to this day, that place is called Perez Uzzah. Now, you got to admit, this is a little bit extreme, don't you think? The ark with the Ten Commandments in it is about to go into the dirt, and Uzzah just instinctively goes, whoa! He's struck down. We believe in a God like this? He's just trying to help. This seems a little extreme, don't you think? Well, what's the answer to this? Well, you know, God's ways are higher than ours, right? Don't we always quote that verse that God's ways are higher than our ways? In fact, here's the famous verse. It's in Isaiah chapter 55. Here's what it says. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Now, just about everybody interprets this passage to mean, look, God's logic and knowledge is so far greater than ours that we can't understand what he's doing all the time. Well, that's certainly true, but that's not what this verse is teaching. Why? Because you have to look at the context. I know it's going to sound a little funny, but it's true. There are no verses in the Bible. There are no verses in the Bible. Do you think when Isaiah is writing Isaiah here, he goes, well, here's chapter 55, verse 1. No, those were put in when? About 500 years ago. Why? To help us navigate the text, which is important because it's a really long series of books. It'd be hard to find your way around if you didn't have numbers on there. The problem is we tend to think numbers, a chapter and a number, makes it so that we can just take that verse out of context and make it say whatever we want. So we need to look at the context here. In fact, Greg Kokel right over here, my friend, has a saying, never read a Bible verse. That's because he's an atheist. No, that's because he doesn't evangelize people, as he said yesterday. No, the reason he's saying that is because you got to figure out what the context is to see what God is communicating. Let's look at the context of this verse. What comes before this? Let's move this down. First of all, we can see a distinction between God's thoughts and our ways and God's ways. But let's take a look and see what this is about. Notice, seek the Lord while he may be found. Call on him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake their ways and the unrighteous their thoughts. Let them turn to the Lord and he will have mercy on them and to our God, for he will freely pardon. Notice the word wicked. The word wicked is modifying your thoughts, your ways in both passages. In other words, God is not making a knowledge point here or a logic point here that God's logic or God's knowledge is so much greater than ours. He's making a moral point here that God's moral ways are better than your wicked ways. Do you see the point? Now, just how much better are God's moral ways than your and my moral ways? Let's examine this verse right in the middle. As the heavens are higher than the earth, as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Well, What's the next question we need to answer? How high are the heavens? Let's take a look. First of all, we're going to start with our solar system. There we are, right here, third rock from the sun. Now, this is not to scale, by the way, because if it was to scale, you couldn't fill this wall, all right? But notice Jupiter right here. You see how big Jupiter is? These dark marks on Jupiter are comet fragment strikes that are bigger than the Earth. Thank God for Jupiter. Because why? What does Jupiter do? Jupiter is so big that it acts as a cosmic vacuum cleaner. Its gravitational force is so strong that it attracts most of the meteors and space junk to it rather than us. If Jupiter wasn't there, we wouldn't be here. This is one of the design arguments for a designer behind the universe. In fact, you want to see the size of Jupiter? Check this out. There's Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Earth. Look at poor Pluto down here. You know, Pluto recently has been demoted as a planet. I don't know about you, but I think it's size discrimination. Take a look at this. You can hardly see Pluto. Take a look at this. That's Arcturus. That's another star in our galaxy. Here's the sun. Jupiter is one pixel in size on this scale. Earth is invisible. Pluto, forget about it, all right? All right, keep an eye on Arcturus now. Here's Arcturus here. Where's Arcturus now? There's Arcturus right here. The sun is one pixel in size on this scale. Jupiter is invisible. Earth, Pluto, forget about them. In fact, if, by the way, this is in our galaxy. This is not outside our galaxy. Some nights you can go out and you can actually see Antares in the sky. You can see it. It's there. But if the Earth was the size of a golf ball, Betelgeuse here, look, I don't name the stars, all right? If the Earth was the size of a golf ball, Betelgeuse would be 5 or 6 Empire State Buildings high. The heavens are awesome. And that's just in our galaxy. These are not stars outside our galaxy. In fact, the average distance between stars in our galaxy is 30 trillion miles, and all that distance is necessary for us to exist here on Earth. If the distances were different, gravitational fields would interrupt orbits, and we wouldn't exist. We couldn't live. About 25 years or so ago, my wife and I took our 3 sons to the Desert Museum here in Tucson, because my in-laws live in Tucson. And we went there one night, and you know, if you go down there on a dark night and it's a clear night, if you're outside at night, you can see thousands of stars in the sky. So we're out there this one night, and the guide goes, "Wow, it's so clear tonight that if we look up at 9:03, we'll see the space shuttle in orbit." Oh, come on, we're not gonna see the space shuttle in orbit. I mean, it's only 120 feet long. It's 350 miles up. We're not gonna see it. Oh, me of little faith. At 9:03, the guide goes, "Look!" And we look up in the sky about 70 degrees above the horizon. There's an object streaking across the western desert sky relative to us about like this. I mean, it's really cooking. When it got right about here, it disappeared. I don't know whether Scotty beamed it up or what. Actually, what happened was, despite the fact that we were in total darkness, the space shuttle was so high up that the sun was still reflecting off of it, and when it got out of the range of the sun, we couldn't see it anymore. Now, when the space shuttle was in orbit, the space shuttle was traveling at about 18,000 miles an hour. That's 5 miles per second. You got trouble getting to work in the morning? Take the space shuttle. You'll be there 5 miles a second. Think about how fast that is. Well, I did a little calculation to try and figure out how long would it take us if we could get in the space shuttle and travel from our star, the sun, to another star in our galaxy, an average distance away, 30 trillion miles. In other words, how long would it take us to go 30 trillion miles if we could go 5 miles per second? How long do you think it would take us? A long time. You must be a math major. It would take us 201,450 years. That means if you got in the space shuttle at the time of Christ and started traveling from our star, the sun, to another star in our galaxy an average distance away, you've been going 5 miles a second for 2,000 years, you'd be less than 1/100th of the way there right now. And we're going to explore space. No, we're not. We're not going anywhere in space. We can hardly get out of our solar system. It took us 9 years to get to Pluto. You can imagine trying to go to another planet somewhere? You would never get there. Who wants to go to the next nearest star? We'll go. Get in, kids! Are we almost there yet, Dad? Another 200,000 years. Play some more Xbox. No! We're not getting there. In fact, the Hubble Space Telescope, as you know, has shown us some amazing pictures. And way back about 25 years ago, 1995 or so, they trained the Hubble on 1/24 millionth of the sky. What's 1/24 millionth of the sky? Go outside tonight, put a piece of rice on the end of your finger, hold it up. That piece of rice represents about 1/24 millionth of the sky. So they trained it for several days on that little piece of sky. And here's what they found. In fact, what I'm going to do is show you the video. It's really a bunch of pictures put together of the piece of sky they zoomed in on the southern hemisphere. When the video starts, you're going to see the constellations come up, and then Hubble's going to zoom in on 1/24 millionth of the sky. You ready? There's no audio. It's just video. Ready? Here we go. Here are the constellations. Here we go. What you're looking at are 10,000 galaxies in 1/24 millionth of the sky. As high as the heavens are above the earth. How many stars are out there? The number of stars that are out there are about equivalent to the number of grains of sand on all the beaches on all the earth times 100,000. Now you know how much higher God's moral ways are than our ways. So when Uzzah reached out his hand to stop the ark from hitting the dirt, what he didn't realize was that his hand was polluted. The dirt does what God tells it to do. You don't do what God tells you to do, and neither do I. We think we're pretty good people. Not according to this standard. Why doesn't God do this to us every day? Because he's patient, wanting all to come to repentance. Apparently, he knew Uzzah had no hope. Or Uzzah may have been a believer, but he said, you don't touch the ark. A God that terrifyingly moral is a God that none of us in this room can contend with. God's too intense. We can't stand up to his holiness, which means he's separate. Yet we think we can. But thankfully, since every one of God's attributes is infinite, so is his love. What does he say about his love in Psalm 103? For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his love for those that fear him. As far as the east from the west is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. And how has he done that? How has he moved our transgressions from us? There's only one way. We can't do it ourselves. We can't remove our transgressions. We're sinners. We're fallen. We're already guilty. Someone else has to do it for us. In fact, you know, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus actually made the Old Testament laws even more drastic when he said, if you even think about lusting, you're guilty. Even if you think about adultery, you're guilty. Even if you're just angry with your brother, you're guilty. I've sinned standing up here. So what's the only way? Brace yourself for this.
As long as I remember, I've been walking through the wilderness, praying to the Father, and waiting for my time. I've come here with a mission, and soon I'll give my life for this world. I'm praying in the garden, and I'm looking for a miracle. I find the journey hard, but it's the reason I was born. And can this cup be passed on? Pray all will be done in this world. So I carry my cross and I carry the shame to the end of the road, through the struggle and pain, and I'll do it for love. No, it won't be in vain. Yes, I carry my cross.
He did this so that God could be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. He's the only way, because that's the only way an infinitely just God can allow unjust people to go unpunished. He has to take the punishment on himself. None of us can do it. We deserve our own punishment. So he enters the bloodstream of humanity and allows the very people that rebelled against him to beat, torture, and kill him so he could rescue them. It's the greatest story ever told. And it happens to be true. No amount of good works is going to change the fact that you've already sinned. By the way, I know as our nation spirals out of control, it seems, a lot of people are asking, are these the last days? Is Jesus going to come back soon? I don't know when Jesus is going to come back in his second coming, but I can guarantee you, everybody sitting in this room, within the next 50 to 75 years, are going to face Jesus. Whether he comes back to take the world over or you go to him because he brings you home, you're going to face Jesus somehow. The only way you're going to get by him is if you have his blood, is if you've accepted his free gift. Have you ever done that? Why wouldn't you? It's free. In fact, when Michael Monsor was buried in Rosecrans Cemetery in San Diego, just about every Navy SEAL showed up for his funeral. And as I mentioned, you know, Navy SEALs wear golden tridents, very hard to earn. Very few people that start SEAL training make it. Those that do, that trident is their identity. So when they went to his funeral, they took off their tridents and they pressed them into his casket. They took their identity and put their identity in the one that died for them. That's what we're supposed to do. But our culture says, no, put your identity in your political party, or put your identity in your sexual orientation, or put your identity in your spouse, or put your identity in your vocation or your bank account. None of those things are ultimate, ladies and gentlemen. We're meant to put our identity in our Savior, the one who created us for him. The one that not only took our punishment, your punishment on himself, but the one who, as J. Warner Wallace just showed you, rose from the dead. Father, I pray that if there's someone here who hasn't accepted the free gift of salvation that Christ has provided, that tonight would be the night that they would. Why would you stay out of the kingdom? In fact, I was speaking at a prison in Ohio a couple of years ago. I went to the prison. I was supposed to speak to a couple of groups of inmates, and the chaplain, when I got there, said, "We'd like you to speak to a third group. Would you do it?" I said, "Sure. Who is it?" They said, "The guy's in solitary confinement." "Okay, bring him up." Now in prison, solitary confinement is known as the hole. So they brought about 20 of these guys up. These were the rapists and the murderers, the MS-13 guys. I mean, they were all tatted up. They had tattoos on their faces, you know. And so they're just me in this room with them, and I'm going through the evidence for Christianity. I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. Some of them aren't paying attention because they're on drugs. They get drugs in prison somehow. But others were paying rapt attention. In fact, one guy in the back when I was done said, "Hey, man! This makes sense!" I said, "Look, I don't know why you're in here, how you got in here, but do you realize, I don't even know if you're ever going to get out, but do you realize that you can have the same identity that people on the outside have? Because in Christianity, you don't achieve your identity, you receive it. It's free. Why wouldn't you take that?" So why is Jesus the only way? Because there's only one way to reconcile infinite justice and infinite love, and that was done at the cross. And it's our job now to let everybody know about that. Whether you're gardening or evangelizing, do something. Amen? All right.